Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I am Maria Casa, Director for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. Today's call is on the record, and the audio file will be available on our website, cfr.org, within the next few days. You can share it with colleagues or classmates, if you like. We are delighted to have Isabel Coleman with us today to discuss democratic and economic transitions. Dr. Coleman is CFR's Senior Fellow and Director of the Civil Society, Markets, and Democracy Initiative. She writes the CFR blog, Democracy in Development, and tweets at Isabel_Coleman. An expert on the Middle East, Dr. Coleman has testified before Congress on Iraq and Afghanistan. She is the author of numerous publications, including Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. This has just come out in a new paperback version this month. In 2011, Newsweek named Dr. Coleman one of 150 women who shake the world. She is also the co-editor of the forthcoming book, Realizing Democracy, Lessons from Transitioning Countries. Welcome, Isabel. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Maria.
Your forthcoming book examines eight countries in various stages of transition. It might be nice if you could begin by providing an overview of these case studies and discuss any policy insights they yield.
Sure, that sounds great. If you look around the world, we've seen some very spectacular revolutions and transitions that have been occurring, whether it's in Egypt or in Tunisia or in Myanmar, elections taking place all over sub-Saharan Africa. It gives a sense that there is democracy happening in the world, that it's deepening in some countries, taking root in others. But when you look at it statistically, the sad fact is that global levels of freedom have actually declined in the world. Freedom House puts out a study every year, and for 7 years in a row, we've seen these declines based on a whole bunch of measures that they have. And democracy scholars now talk about a democratic recession going on, despite these very high-profile cases that we've seen. So part of the reason is that democracy and democratization is not just simply the holding of elections. It's a whole number of factors that come together to not only have majority rule through free and fair elections, but also to ensure strong minority and civil rights protections. And when you look at a country like Egypt today that is really struggling with some very profound issues on things like freedom of religion and freedom of speech, you realize how difficult this transition is. And it doesn't happen overnight. It can take a very, very long time. And the factors that go into a successful democratic transition versus those that stall or regress are not even that well understood. There was a time where people believed in modernization theory that just as countries got richer, that they would inevitably democratize. But we have so many examples now around the world of countries that have become wealthy but not more democratic. And so we know, in fact, that that's not an inevitable process. So behind this book, we decided to look at eight different studies of countries that have gone through transition, some more successfully than others, and those include Mexico, Brazil, Poland, South Africa, Indonesia, Thailand, Ukraine, and Nigeria. Now, these are not intended to be a representative sample, but to encompass a whole range of experiences and outcomes with geographic diversity and also some pretty high geopolitical relevance. These are important countries. And we know that some of them have done exceedingly well and others have stumbled. And what we did is look specifically at six different factors that the statistical research indicates are very important to that whole process of democratization. And this includes, number one, socioeconomic exclusion and inclusion. How are the weakest members of society, socioeconomically, the most disadvantaged members of society, how are they affected by the transition? How are their how is their economic prosperity and aspirations met? How are their legal rights protected? We also look at economic structure and policies as a second element. What decisions does the government make, this transitioning government, about how to organize itself economically, how to allocate precious and scarce resources? The third is around civil society and media. Very important, as we all know from watching the news about the role of young people in the Middle East revolutions, the role of the new media like Facebook and Twitter, but also, of course, just plain old civil society blocking and tackling, organizing to get people formed into political parties, being able to express their opinion, being able to speak truth to power in a very real way in these new emerging systems. Fourth are legal systems and rule of law. Vitally important that people understand that their rights are protected, that their property is protected in the new systems. Fifth is government structure and division of power. Many of these countries have gone from transitions where they were military dictatorships to a system where there's a more widespread, diffused form of power. How do you get, in many cases, the critical issue is how do you get the military back into the barracks? Of course, this is a big question overhanging Egypt today. The military has had a very central role in the country. It's still very much there on the sidelines, and you're beginning to hear more and more rumors today about the possibility of a counter-revolution, a military coup led by disgruntled Mubarak-era generals. So that's a very real issue. And looking at these case studies, it's not something unique, of course, to Egypt. You've had prominent the role of the military in countries from Nigeria to Indonesia to Brazil. So these are experiences that we can learn something from. And the last thing is education and demography. The decisions that governments make to invest or not to invest in the future of their populations are all critical to these democratic transitions. Because as we know, these transitions do not happen overnight. They take a very, very long time. I've never liked the term Arab Spring because spring implies it's something short and sweet. And in fact, what we're watching unfold in the Middle East today is a very long and inevitably will be a somewhat torturous process with lots of ebbs and flows and, you know, a step forward and a couple steps back. And how young people fare in that process, how their both economic aspirations and political aspirations are realized becomes an all-critical factor in the success of these transitions. So looking across all of these case studies, what we came up with is just a few key points to keep in mind. The first is that economic growth, as I mentioned earlier, this whole modernization theory that economic growth inevitably leads to democratization, I think has been pretty largely discredited at this point. But what does stand the test is that economic crisis actually leads to regime change and can lead to some very profound transitions more broadly in the transitioning country. If a country has reached a certain level of economic development when that transition occurs, it does make it less likely that they're going to backslide away from the democratic transition. So unfortunately, you know, Egypt is still quite a poor country. Its prospects of a smooth transition are lessened statistically by that. But you're seeing this role of economic crisis play a role in the transition, and there's been a lot written about the rising food prices around the world and rising commodity prices in general, and that how that really played into the timing of Egypt's and the other Arab revolutions that occurred in 2011. The second point I'd make is that one of the things that we see across all of our case studies, and we match this with some statistical evidence too, is that electoral experience, even the sham trappings of electoral competition under authoritarianism, make democratic transitions more likely to succeed once they begin. And by that, you know, one of the interesting takeaways for me in all of these different case studies is that many of these governments under authoritarian systems nevertheless held elections. In some cases, like Mexico, they were so concerned about making sure that they seemed to be democratic that they even supported in a limited way the opposition such that they could maintain this pretense of electoral competition. And yet, that experience, even though it is not a robust electoral experience, it does create some voter muscle memory in the population. It does create an expectation of electoral competition. It puts in place the apparatus for voting, whether it's national identity cards or polling stations or whatever it may be, that when the country does go through a real transition, it makes it a whole lot smoother and more likely to succeed. The third point is that democratic transitions that start in a violent manner are much less likely to succeed. And alternatively, those that are driven by peaceful mass popular mobilizations are more likely to succeed. And not only because of the fact that, you know, you look at a country like Syria today, which is in the midst of a civil war. I just read that the estimates now for rebuilding Syria today range north of $60 billion. And if the fight goes to Damascus, that will get even much, much larger than it is. So peaceful transitions, of course, you don't have the ravages of war. But on the positive side, you also have this broadly engaged population who feel bought into the transition. And that's one of the very positive things I see going on in Egypt, a country I travel to frequently. People are feeling nervous, agitated, scared by what they're seeing going on around them, but there's still a very high level of buy-in to the whole transition. And that comes from this mass mobilization that we're talking about. And then just a few other points, and then I'll turn to your question. In terms of what really matters once countries start their transition, choices on three fronts turn out to be very, very critical. The first is delivering on expectations for social and economic opportunities. So the promise of political freedom raises people's expectations for economic opportunity, and failing to deliver on those raised expectations makes a return to authoritarianism more likely. So countries that are able to meet the aspirations of their populations, particularly from an economic perspective, while they're putting in place social safety nets, have more likelihood of success. And you look at a country like Poland, which went through a very radical economic restructuring, and it took years. This didn't happen overnight. It took years and years of pain, of recession, of economic loss, state companies going out of business. But they did it in a very determined way, and putting in place social safety nets so that those workers and those pensioners and those who were most at risk had something to fall back on, and as they transition to a new economic model. Indonesia, likewise, has gone through some very radical restructuring, but has implemented a social safety net. Brazil, Mexico, other countries that have done the same thing, using cash transfers to the poorest elements of society to help raise them up as they're going through these economic transitions. The second thing I'll mention is establishing the rule of law. Rule of law reforms that create a fair and level playing field that break the elite's stranglehold on wealth and opportunities and protect freedoms are really essential to the success of and sustainability of transitions. And then the third thing that we found interesting across all of these case studies is that devolving government power away from the center and towards localities is often a way of deepening democratization. There's, in many of these cases, autocratic governments really control power very closely at the center. And by giving it in this new system that they transition to, giving it to more power to regions, to local communities, helps make politicians more accountable and democracy more likely to deliver for citizens. We have examples of this from Poland, from Mexico, from Indonesia. Even in Nigeria's case, it wasn't an explicit idea to devolve power. It's just happened that way because the central government is so inept that the glimmers of hope now in Nigeria are really coming at a local level through capable governors, capable leaders at a regional and local level who are able to cut through the ineptitude of the central government and actually deliver for their people. So I've thrown a lot out on the table here. I'm happy to answer any of your questions. But I'll just wrap up by saying that, you know, personally, I'm committed to the idea that, yes, for all of its flaws out there, democracy is, I think, still the best option that we have. I think you see populations in countries that have grown rich but not democratic, they are looking around and agitating for more freedom. It hasn't happened in a country yet like China or Saudi Arabia, but you see those populations, as a middle class grows, looking around and wondering why they don't have the freedoms that others have, and you know there's no definitive answer on this, but democracy I think is the best system still, and figuring out how to help those countries that are going through democratic transitions be more successful, be more sustainable over the long term. Is something I'm going to keep working on. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone. Questions will be taken in the order that they're received. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star one now. Our first question comes from a caller from Texas University.
Hi, this is Michael, and thank you for your comments. I certainly concur with you that democracy is the best way moving forward. Question about your very last point you made about sharing of this power. Unfortunately, although the lessons in Poland and Nigeria that you mentioned were positive, this may not be universal. For instance, in some other developing countries, they've ended up having fiefdoms by the local power sharers, which end up to try to be, I guess, do things that are that lead to sub-optimization from the central democracy. And there's numerous examples of this leading to more conflict and violent revolution. Your thoughts on this, please.
Thank you. That's a very good point. And I think we are talking about two slightly different things. One is a thoughtful devolution of power, and that's the center explicitly giving up power to the state or to the government level. And by that, we're not talking about military power. We're not talking about typically, interior ministry type powers. We're not talking about security of the state. What we're really talking about is economic power, the power to to levy taxes at a local level and to deliver those taxes to meet the needs of the local population, to manage education at a more local level. In many of these countries, everything is very centrally organized, very driven top-down, and what you see is that often feeds into this very notion of sectarianism or ethnic conflict that you're talking about. In Indonesia's case, they were facing, while they went through, you know, their transition was really triggered by the Asian economic crisis in 1998. And at the same time, you had growing sectarianism, growing a push on the parts of some places, Aceh, for example, to secede from the country. And by devolving power, it was able to blunt that motion towards dissolution of the state. And by giving localities more control over the purse string, giving localities more control over their court systems, giving localities more control over education and these types of very tangible issues that people care very directly about, they were able to blunt those secessionist pressures and also deliver against the democratic aspirations better. Now, one very clear downside of this is that graft, corruption, does become more diffuse, and you've seen that in the case of Indonesia. You've seen it in the case, for example, of Mexico, which has also devolved power. And so you do see, before, if you wanted to deal with the Indonesian government, you were paying bribes to a certain set of people in Jakarta. Now you're really paying bribes at all different levels of the government, not only centrally in Jakarta, but then, you know, at the regional level and even at the local level. But others have argued that while this diffusion of graft is happening, it isn't necessarily increasing the level of graft. It's spreading it throughout the country, which has an insidious effect, but it also has the positive effect of spreading it around and spreading the wealth, so to say, from Jakarta. So I think there's a division of opinion on how bad that actually is.
Thank you, Isabel. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Seattle University.
Or it's good afternoon.
Yes, our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
How effective is microfinance in advancing the role of women in civil society in transitioning countries?
Microfinance, I think, is almost more important in the lead-up to transitions. So when you have, you know, a transition that's going on, there's a lot of dislocation in society. And this dislocation can result in economic downturns. It makes it hard for microfinance institutions to operate in a sustainable fashion in that tumultuous environment. It's hard for microfinance institutions to be sustainable under the best of circumstances. You would find them quite hard-pressed to be operating effectively, say, in Egypt today. But microfinance is, while I think it has disappointed many on a macroeconomic level, we do have a fair amount of data that it does help engage women in particular in an active political, social way. So we do have studies, longitudinal studies over decades now, showing that women in Bangladesh, for example, who take microfinance loans are more likely to vote, they're more likely to run for office, they're more likely to be aware of what's going on in their local community, more engaged politically. And I think that's true in many countries, whether it's microfinance or whether it's a movement that you, like what Wangari Maathai started in East Africa around environmental awareness and planting trees. Any of these things that bring people together in a civic way has a political component to it also.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Seattle University.
Good afternoon, Ms. Coleman. My name is Jackson. I wanted to ask you about at least what is, in my view, the big one, at least in the Middle East region. I grew up in Saudi Arabia, and I never thought that we would see the things happening across the Middle East region that we have, in fact, seen in the past couple of years. Never, or at least not in my lifetime. And so I wanted to ask, I read one of your articles in the blog, so long as the resource wealth continues, will the Saudi government be able to simply just buy off the entire populace, or do you, in fact, see an end for them in the foreseeable future, an end for, potentially, for the system of governance there?
Well, I think my answer to both of those questions is yes. I think that as long as the wealth continues, they are able to buy off their population. And I don't know what blog you're referring to, but I wrote a piece recently looking at attitudes of Saudi youth. There have been a number of studies done recently looking at Saudi youth, and I think one takeaway from that is that this is a group of young people who, in many respects, are economically comfortable and therefore have evolutionary hopes, not revolutionary hopes. And the emphasis on evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary deepens as they look at the chaos going on around them in their region. They are very wary of the developments that have happened in Egypt. They look at that and think, oh, you know, we don't want that here. Syria is, of course, even a more frightening situation. Iraq is filled with fear for the comfortable Saudi life. That said, they want more freedom, they want more personal autonomy, they want more transparency, more accountability in government. All of the things that express would lead to greater democratization. And there's the rub. This is Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. It's not a country that is in any way comfortable of any type of power sharing. So how that evolutionary process can happen is not clear to me. You do see, steps in a direction of greater public participation, but not real power sharing. I think that the second answer is also yes, do I see it coming to an end? Because even though the Saudis have enormous oil reserves, the basic conundrum is that the population doubles every, 20, 25 years. And the amount of money that they have to buy off their population on a per capita basis is going down by the day. The other thing is that, yes, they have enormous oil reserves, but as their population increases, as their own energy consumption increases, they are consuming more and more of their natural resources, which allows less for export and, again, puts more pressure on their ability to buy off their population. So from my perspective, it is not a never-ending gravy train that the Al-Sauds can rely on, that in fact there will be a day of reckoning, and the more proactive they are in understanding that and taking steps to move to a transition that they can control, if they can control it, is better than a revolution that's going to overthrow them in a more violent fashion.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the University of the South.
Hi, Dr. Coleman. This is Carter Pearson at Swanee, the University of the South. I was wondering if you thought that the democratic recession that you mentioned could be related to the global recession that we've experienced since 2008, as some tenets of modernization theory, specifically Christian Wenzel and Ronald Engelhardt, have suggested a link between a movement to post-industrial values and democratic transition and consolidation. Thank you.
Sure. Interesting question. I think that economic dislocation has two effects. What we see from our study is that economic crisis is what, in many respects, triggers these transitions. You can look at the economic crisis. I mentioned the rising commodity prices and prices and food in particular playing a role in the Arab revolutions. The Asian financial crisis, of course, played a role in Indonesia's transition. The Latin American debt crisis played a huge role in both Brazil and Mexico's transition. The dissolution of the Soviet Union, and from an economic perspective, of course, was behind the fall of the Berlin Wall and Poland's transition. So economic crisis can trigger the change, but it can also make those countries that are going through transition, it's a lot harder when you are challenged in terms of economic growth and in delivering on the aspirations of your population. This democracy deficit I refer to predates the economic crisis by several years. We had seen an increase in, measurable democratization around the world at the turn of the millennium, the early part of the 2000s. And then after those colored revolutions occurred in the former Soviet republics that then stalled and even reversed, we've been on a pretty steady decline since then. Now, will these recent transitions that we see happening in the Middle East, in Asia, in Africa, will they reverse that trend? That's my hope. And of course, they're taking place in a very difficult, under very difficult economic circumstances.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Washington University.
Hello. I was wondering if you could. Oh, sorry. My name is Evan Peters. I was wondering if you could address the role, how you can get an executive branch to recognize the legitimacy of a judicial branch, particularly when they make decisions in conflict with an executive branch decision. Thank you.
Well, that's a great question, and it doesn't necessarily happen overnight. In many cases, you see an evolutionary process. You see, as a first step, a constitution being written that gives independence to the judiciary in a de jure sense, but not necessarily in a de facto sense. And that can be a process that takes a long time. If you look at our own experience in the United States, our judiciary has evolved enormously. And there were some very profound, moments of truth along the way, particularly in the early years, that set the judiciary up as a more powerful entity than some were comfortable with. But that ultimately really put some oomph into this idea of separation of powers. You've got, in a country like Mexico, for example, you have an independent judiciary, but it's a judiciary that is compromised in many respects. It's compromised for lack of, trained human capital, lack of judges who really are trained and understand and are run a competent court. It's also compromised, of course, by corruption, by intimidation and fear through the quite pervasive drug trafficking and trade. But you also have a government in Mexico that recognizes the issues and is pouring quite a bit of money into bolstering the judiciary and making it stronger. And that's an area that they've put a lot of emphasis into. So here's a country, again, it's an evolution. I referred to some of the orange, the colored revolutions and the orange revolution in Ukraine. One of the reasons that it failed so spectacularly, I think, is because the judiciary was never independent and was never allowed to be independent. So from the get-go, even though there were constitutional clauses that created a judiciary, it was always under the control of the autocrats and the oligarchs in the country. And property has never been secure. rule of law has never been implemented, and that at the most fundamental level is an explanation for why that transition has largely failed.
Thank you, Isabel. Next question, please.
Yes, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Our next question comes from the Colin Powell Center. Caller, your line is open.
Good afternoon, Ms. Coleman. This is Marwan Hamid from Colin Powell Center. My question is, I would like to go back to what you mentioned earlier about the economic crisis that could lead to the regime change or the transition. Do you think that this could happen in Egypt, since the IMF is pushing for a fiscal policy change as a precondition for the loans to be given to Egypt?
Well, I think this is part of what I'm talking about, which is, look, Egypt has had very expensive subsidies in place for decades and has lived with those subsidies. You can look back in the 1970s when the IMF tried then to get, at the time, President Sadat to reform the subsidies at that point. And when he made a move to cut back on food subsidies, wheat in particular, there were riots in the street in 1977, and it was only quelled when the military came out. So there's a lot of fear on the part of the Egyptians of messing with subsidies, and yet they are inefficient, they're corrupt, they're bad for the environment, and we know that they're hugely unproductive. They don't really go to the poorest of the poor who really need the subsidies. They're propping up inefficient industry and going to the middle and upper middle classes, or being, smuggled out of the country into a significant black market. We know that, and yet a huge amount of Egyptian national wealth is going to these subsidies. So, now from my perspective, when I look at what is happening in Egypt, the economic crisis is forcing, because you have both rising commodity prices and slowing, economy in Egypt. As a percent of the government budget, the subsidies are now over a third of government spending. It's just become absolutely unsustainable, which is forcing the government to do something it should have done many, many years ago, that would make the Egyptian economy more productive, stronger, and actually free up resources to really invest in the poor elements of the population. And, so I see this as an opportunity. I understand that it's filled with political uncertainty, but this is something that has been long in the making. Every Egyptian government has known that they need to do this, but have been unwilling to exert the political will. And here's now an opportunity from this crisis to do the right thing, in effect. Of course, we just have in the news today that Qatar has agreed to give the Egyptian government another $3 billion, which, it's just prolonging the inevitable, that the money is being deposited into the central bank, it's being used to prop up the currency, and to delay this critical, difficult, challenging, undoubtedly, economic restructuring that needs to happen. And I'm not suggesting that poor Egyptians just be cut off and left to suffer, but there are ways of transitioning away from grossly inefficient subsidies to, through cash transfers to the poor. This is something India is experimenting with now. Ghana, when it reformed subsidies, Iran, when it reformed its subsidies, relied on cash transfers to dull the burden of this transition for those who would be most affected. So I see this as actually really an opportunity for the Egyptian economy, which has been really weighted down from the growth and efficiency of its subsidies.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Our next question comes from Columbia University.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, Elizabeth. It's always great to hear your perspective on how societies transition. I'm wondering, my question is specifically on women's rights and where we have gained ground and where actually and where we've gone backwards. And so in some places like Egypt, we're seeing violence against women in huge number of proportion, even in public spaces. So how can we actually move forward on this agenda?
Well, thank you for a question always near and dear to my heart. You know, I think, sadly, you know, in every place we've lost ground on women's rights, but we've also gained ground, too. It's not it's not a clear picture. And let's stick with the example from Egypt. There has been horrific politically motivated sexual violence against women in Egypt. We know that. And it has, you know, risen at a startling rate over the last couple of years, both from a breakdown of law and order in society and as a tool of intimidation and fear by various forces in the society to really try to get women out of the square and try to humiliate women and get them to go back home. But the reason I see it as a much more mixed picture is because what you're also seeing going on in Egypt is a defiance among women and men saying, no, we're not going to go home. And not only are we not going to go home, but we're going to talk about this in a very public way. We're going to create, this is going back to civil society, we're going to create multiple civil society groups to, you know, address this issue head on. I just had a group of young Egyptian men and women who were here on a State Department visit, and they are representative of all different aspects of civil society, but a couple of them are filmmakers. And what are they making films about? Sexual violence against women. One of them is a journalist. What is she writing about? Sexual violence against women. Another had created a new NGO. What was the focus of the NGO? Sexual violence against women. I was astounded. You know, I could have gone searching in Egypt 3 years ago, and you'd hardly find anyone who'd be willing to talk about it. Suzanne Mubarak was the, you know, quintessential head of women's rights in Egypt, and she poured her energies into human trafficking, really looking outside of Egypt and discouraging any type of attention on these issues internally to the country. And yes, you've seen this rise, this spike in sexually politically motivated sexual violence against women, but you've also seen a huge pushback and a digging in and a determination. You've also seen so many women taking to the streets, being active in a whole range of ways, whether it's politically or civically minded or through media or whatever it is. You just see an unleashing of women's determination in that country. So while times look very tough now, and you do see some very depressing headlines coming out of Egypt, I think there's some tremendous sources of strength underneath that.
Next question, please.
Yes, our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Good afternoon from the Richard Stockton College. Do you find that multinational corporations exploit countries in transition for their own benefit in terms of lobbying for more favorable regulation, or have they been negatively affected by...
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of that. Have they been negatively affected?
I said in terms of lobbying for more favorable regulations, or have they been negatively affected by new democratic transitions?
You know, that's an interesting question. You see it cut both ways. You've seen some multinational companies that had, shall we call them, sweetheart deals with the authoritarian government, which is now out of power. You've seen those sweetheart deals unravel, particularly in extractive industries. You've seen them face more competition, more transparency in procurement and bidding, which they're not necessarily happy about. And so you've seen that happen in a number of cases. On the other hand, you've also seen, as these democratic transitions have occurred, you've seen greater emphasis on rule of law, on transparency, on a level playing field, which in for the vast majority of companies operating around the world, they all view as a good thing. For those who are losing a privileged position, you know, they may look unfavorably on the transition, but in general, net-net, to the extent that these transitions do lead to greater rule of law, more independent judiciary, more emphasis on property rights, freedom of speech, more active civil society, these are things that, for the most part, are encouraging and enticing to foreign direct investment.
Thank you, Isabel. Next question, please.
Yes, next question is from Great Neck North.
Hi. Do you think that the sham elections are a detriment to the countries and because they deter people from voting? And do you think they will induce violent revolts, which will regress the democratization that's been occurring?
Well, this was one of the points that I found very interesting from our case studies, is that these sham elections actually, in some cases, had unintended consequences. Governments thought they could hold a sham election and tightly control the outcome, and in some cases they couldn't, whether it was in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine or even going back to the surprising showing that the Solidarity Movement had under the communist government in Poland before the back in 1980, which really launched the movement. Or in Mexico, you saw the opposition party, or and in Brazil, too, do surprisingly well, which, in fact, had the effect of putting the idea in people's minds that these governments are not invincible, that they are vulnerable, and that if they keep at it and keep organizing and keep pushing their message out, that there is a possibility of change. The other thing is that these elections, even to the extent that they're not free and fair elections, they have the result of organizing people, of organizing civil society, of organizing of political ideas. I go back to the example of Egypt. Under pressure from the Bush administration, the Mubarak regime in 2005 allowed a sham election to occur. The Muslim Brotherhood was not allowed to be organized as a political party, but it put forward candidates. It self-censored. It didn't want to push too far too fast, so it ran a limited number of candidates, but it still got 20% of the parliament, and through that electoral process became the largest opposition party in Egypt. And that was, in many ways, a very important step in its evolution, that now it was in parliament, and you had people in the country saying, so, Muslim Brotherhood, hey, Ikhwan, what do you stand for? And they came under pressure to articulate a policy platform, which they did. They put that out in 2007, to not insignificant controversy. There were a couple elements of that party platform, in particular, the statement that neither a non-Muslim, in Egypt's case, this means that Coptic Christian, nor a woman could be president of the country. And it created a real debate within the Muslim Brotherhood over why that was part of their party platform. It it played into the worst fears of people who say, look, they're against women's rights and they're against non-Muslims and all of these things. And it triggered a political debate within the Muslim Brotherhood that you see going on today. And, you know, frankly, it's an evolutionary process that you see happening. And I'm glad that it started at least back in 2007, so they had a little bit of time to begin thinking about some of these ideas before they were thrust into power, because, frankly, I think they're unprepared for power, and they have worn it pretty badly. And I can only imagine how much worse it would have been had they not had a few years of participation in the last government. But you know, this is a long way of saying that these sham elections and the participation of groups in these not free and fair elections does have some benefits.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Yes, our next question comes from Washington University.
Hi, my name is Masha Masyev, and I have a question about Egypt and its geopolitical region. A lot of the developments that Egypt is forced to address are very event-based, and that has a disruptive impact on Egyptian society, and a lot of these events are unpredictable. For example, like, you know, releases of certain independent films, tensions with its neighbors. How does a country like Egypt, who is in transition, prepare for long-term sustainability when you have unpredictable and largely sporadic events to address?
Well, that's a question that's not unique to Egypt. I mean, you know, stuff happens and stuff goes on. And you look at any country that's gone through transition, you have, you know, a remarkable set of events that are swirling around both internally and externally, and a lot of it cannot be controlled. So, you know, it comes back to staying the course, and I think that's why this incident with Bassem Youssef in Egypt, who's widely referred to as the John Stewart of Egypt, is such a profound, you know, watershed in many ways for the country, because it's testing the principle of freedom of speech. And this is a principle that President Morsi claims to abide by. If any of you, and I encourage all of you to watch the John Stewart takedown of Bassem Youssef's imprisonment in Egypt and his arrest, and of course he's been let out on bail now, but watch that. He shows clips of President Morsi himself saying, look, I was imprisoned for my beliefs. I was imprisoned for what I believed in politically, and I will never let that happen to anybody else. And no one will ever go to prison for criticizing the president again. Now, here you have Bassem Youssef being arrested exactly for criticizing the president, and Morsi's largely silent on the topic. So, you know, to me, this is one of those examples of an event that that takes over. You know, you referred to this quote documentary that was made, you know, this film on the life of Muhammad, you know, that was so incendiary. Well, stuff happens, you know, people get angry, they protest, but, you know, the government needs to maintain law and order. It needs to protect foreign embassies that are in its country, and it failed on a number of these fronts. So these become much bigger issues and emblematic of much bigger trends and challenges in society, particularly when the government chooses wrong.
Thank you, Isabel. Next question, please.
Yes, our next question comes from Texas University.
Thank you. Just a question regarding if you were advising the head of state, the new government, let's say that's elected, for a flavor of democracy, what would your suggestion, recommendation be, and why?
Just so I understand, I'm advising the new head of state in one of these transitioning countries.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. So, you know, I would, I guess I come back to this case study project, which has, you know, really informed my thinking, but I would focus very much on rule of law and getting that right, making sure that that there is a level playing field, that there is an independent judiciary, that people and institutions respect the rule of law. And again, that's why I come back to this Bassem Youssef case on freedom of speech. It's such a profound issue for Egypt right now. But making sure that there are rules in place and that the rules are followed. And if you look at Mexico, new president in Mexico has chosen to, you know, out of the gate, do something really quite remarkable, which is go after the corrupt head of the teachers union, who everyone has known for years and years that she's corrupt. But, you know, she's been arrested. And this is a huge takedown and a huge stake in the ground saying, you know, no longer business as usual. This is something we really care about. And to do it in the educational realm is also so important because education is the future of the country. And that's the second thing I would focus on. There's lots and lots of pressure on these governments to deliver on multiple levels. And one of the somewhat poignant lessons, I think, that comes out of South Africa is back when its transition happened, there was such remarkable high hopes and high expectations of what would come. And there was a, you know, complete and total political transformation that happened in that country. But economically, there was almost no transformation. And today, and I urge you to read our South Africa study, South Africa is an even more unequal society today than it was at the time of transition. Whites hold a larger share of the economy today than they did in 1994, in excess of 85%. And so although you've seen the rise of some, you know, high-profile black millionaires in South Africa, the economic rules of the game didn't change, and wealth is still highly, highly concentrated. And the government at that point, to meet the expectations of its people, what did it choose to invest in? It invested in housing. I understand why. You know, there were millions of people who were living horribly deprived lives in townships, no running water, shacks, no infrastructure to speak of, and that's what the government poured its money into. But look, there are finite resources to go around, and it was at the expense of education. And today, the prospects of a poor black child getting educated in South Africa are as bad as they were 20 years ago. And that's the future of the country. So rule of law, number one. Number two, I would, you know, really emphasize education. And number three is this whole issue of figuring out a way to make sure that as you go through these economic transitions, these economic dislocations that are inevitable in this type of transition, and we've been talking earlier about the reform of subsidies in Egypt, to make sure that you put in place social safety nets that take care of the weakest and poorest in society. And Brazil has made, you know, spectacular headway on this in terms of its Bolsa Família and other programs, cash transfers to, you know, the bottom 20%. Mexico has done the same, Oportunidades. Indonesia has done something similar. Nigeria has failed spectacularly on this front. Its oil revenues have increased significantly, and so little money trickles down. This is really, this whole issue of economic inclusion is something that I would urge these governments to focus on.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the call back over to Ms. Casa for closing remarks.
Thank you, Isabel. You've raised some exciting questions to explore. And thanks to all of you around the country and the world for your excellent comments and questions. Our next and final call of the semester will take place on Thursday, April 25th at 12 noon Eastern Time. Adam Siegel, CFR's Senior Fellow for China Studies, will discuss China and cybersecurity. We will look forward to hearing from you then.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, CFR.org.